Welcome to the Archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. What do psychiatrists do, and what should psychiatrists not do? What is the psyche? What is crazy? What are causes of mental dysfunction? What medicines are available to assist people with mental health problems, and what other resources are available? Answers to these questions are here in this program, the first of a two-part series recorded in the fall of 1997 about psychiatry with Dr. Richard Gardner, a practicing psychiatrist in Ukiah, California. We begin when I asked him, "What do psychiatrists do?"
Well, psychiatrists are physicians, and they specialize in illnesses that pertain to what we call the mind. And the organ that's the organ of the body that controls the mind is the brain. The brain is like the hardware, and the mind is the software or the programs to go right into a computer analogy. And so mind has a lot of ramifications and a lot of functions. It's what essentially makes us think we are who we are. It's the ability to feel and to think and to behave in certain ways and to be aware of the fact that we are feeling, thinking, and behaving. It's the thing that connects us with the world that we see that surrounds us and the world that we experience inside of us.
And this is something that we inherit and we're socialized to develop.
Right. The mind, the brain, which is the organ that allows the mind to exist, is something that we inherit both through our parents and our grandparents, etc., but also that gets formed. It's not a static organ, it is a dynamic one. It's one that is constantly changing. It's a system of electricity with 100 billion neurons firing at a rate, I've been told, of 100 billion megahertz, 100 billion actual activities going on every single second.
And all at once.
All at once, and in different directions and for different purposes. And that's happening all the time. And it's also very dynamic. In other words, pathways that are activated are remembered better than pathways that aren't activated. So, for instance, if you are currently doing logarithmic functions in mathematics, if that's what they still do in school, and then 40 years later, and you're very good at it, and you know it really well, and then 40 years later you think, what was a logarithm, and I can't even remember that. Those pathways have not been re-stimulated over the time since then, and then they will be very difficult to access. But once you start accessing them, the synapses, the little connections between the nerves that were there, start to say, oh, I remember that, and they start to grow new synapses, and it will be faster to learn logarithms the second time, unless you're so old that your brain isn't working very well, than it was the first time.
Then this is true of anything that we learn, whether it's language or physical skills or mental skills.
Sure, riding a bicycle. They say once you know how to do it, you can do it. And a bicycle riding, balancing, steering, controlling the velocity, etc., is not a function of your muscles and the nerves out there that are controlling your wrists or your legs or whatever. It's something that's remembered through this phenomenal thing that we call our brain. It's remembered in pathways, electrical and chemical, in our brain.
Of what it feels like.
Of what it feels like. And what it feels like is, again, you think you feel it in your fingertips. You think you feel a kiss on your lips, but it is remembered really in the brain, because the experiment would be, your lips have been removed surgically. Can you still sort of remember what a kiss was like if you have your brain? Yes. Now, keep your lips and remove the brain, and the lips aren't going to remember very much.
Like stories of people who have had an arm or a leg amputated.
Yes.
They can still feel the pain in their foot or their hand that's gone.
Right, that's called phantom limb, where the limb is gone, there's nothing there, but the brain has a memory, and so people can say they feel great pain tingling in their toes, and yet there's no limb below the knee.
In some people, these synapses, or these electrical links in the brain, don't work right.
Right.
What are the causes?
Well, first of all, I have to say that they are electrical links, as you said, but to be more precise, they're really chemical links, because the brain is this collection of nerves, 100 billion of them, And instead of being hardwired the same way the electricity in your house is, where the two electrical wires touch each other and they're soldered closed, or they may be opened at a time of a switch, in the brain, the nerve cells that talk to each other, and each nerve talks to approximately 100,000 other nerves all at once. And so we have the 100 billion each connecting to 100,000 others, and then their little synapses, etc. They don't touch. There's a little space between them, and that space is a very important piece of geography. And that space is called a synapse, which is just a Greek word for space. It's also called a synaptic cleft. And the electricity that comes down one nerve, in order to jump over that space and get to the next nerve, instead of making an electrical connection, there's actually a tiny chemical, which we call a neurotransmitter. That's a nerve transmitter. And that chemical goes into the space and bathes the space with millions of molecules of that chemical. And then that chemical can go to the next nerve and go in a place that we call a receptor, which is specific, geometrically specific for the receptor. It's like a key in a keyhole. So the neurotransmitter is a key that's floating in the space. But remember, there are millions of these keys, and there are millions of receptors or keyholes, and that neurotransmitter goes in the keyhole and then causes the next nerve to fire. So it gets, we call it depolarization. It's a very subtle process, so it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can be anywhere from a minute response to a very dramatic response, so that every time someone touched you, you wouldn't have a seizure, but you could experience a light touch is a light touch, and a heavy touch is a heavy touch, and a painful touch is a painful touch, so that more neurotransmitter, more nerves being fired.
Well, when we're learning something, what causes the neurotransmitter to be in that part of our brain at that moment ready to create the link?
There are many pathways in the brain and many neurotransmitters. We know of over 200 neurotransmitters, but actually about 5 of them have been studied intensively, and there are many others that haven't been studied very intensely.
Well, tell us about the studies.
Okay, and what causes them to be there is, I mean, that's the way it's always been. If you look at humans, and then you go back to apes, and then you go back to whales or whatever, far back in the phylogenetic tree, all animals have neurotransmitters, so they've been there for as long as there have been animals. I don't think that plants have neurotransmitters, but maybe they do, and I hope some botanist will call and correct us on that one. But in any case, there are different pathways, and pathways control different functions of the brain.
In different parts of the brain, different functions are controlled.
Correct, but also very intricately interconnected. So we can say that you have the serotonergic system, the system that works on the neurotransmitter molecule serotonin. Or you can say you have the noradrenergic system that works on an epinephrine-like or adrenaline-like molecule, or the GABAergic system. But those systems have elaborate connections with each other, feedback controls, etc. And they are geographically located in different parts of the brain, and they're also connected to each other. So when you smell a rose and it gives you a good feeling, you can also be remembering the pain of the time that you leaned over to smell a rose and a bee bit you on the nose. And so then you have an emotional memory and you have a sensory memory of the smell, and you might even remember the warm summer day upon which this experienced. Or you might even start to think about, boy, I meant to give a rose to that girl in the third grade, but I forgot to do it and some other guy won her over. So it's all connected. So as I talk in a stream of consciousness type manner, that's just the teeniest inkling of the connections that the brain is doing. And most of what the brain does is not done on a conscious level. The vast majority of what the brain does is done at an unconscious level. So connections are being made that we're not aware of, or that we can only become aware of through great work on our part.
The ratio of unconscious to conscious is about 95% unconscious.
Well, the way I look at it is that the picture the Pacific Ocean, and then there's a wave on the Pacific Ocean, and then there's a spray coming off of that wave. I look at the spray as what's conscious. I look at the wave as what's pre-conscious, meaning that we can access without too much great difficulty. Like, if I asked you now, what did you eat for breakfast? you would think about it for a moment and then you'd remember it. You weren't conscious of it before I asked you, but you could get to it, so that's preconscious. And then the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, that's the unconscious. And that's the stuff that we can't get at. Like, but, for instance, what did you have for breakfast 4 years ago?
But that's the stuff that controls so much of our interpersonal and intrapersonal reactions.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you see one person and you have a reaction that says, oh my gosh, I don't want to have anything to do with that person. And you see another person and perhaps smell them or whatever, and you're madly in love with them, and you're off and running on a rest of your life relationship.
I want to ask you about that, but first I want to say that you're listening to Radio Curious, and we're talking about the makeup of the brain and psychiatric issues. My guest is Dr. Richard Gardner, a practicing psychiatrist in Ukiah. The unconscious, the mass of the Pacific Ocean, far greater than the 95% figure that I gave a few minutes ago. How does that control our lives?
Well, recognizing now that we're in the realm of theory, because what we know about the brain is we know it weighs about 3 pounds, we know approximately how many neurons it has in it, and we know what various parts of the brain do, so that we used to know it by unfortunate experiments, such as someone got shot in the head and a certain part of their brain was removed, and then they weren't able to do something. So if you got, or if you had a stroke and it goes to the left motor cortex of the brain, it means that on the right side of the brain there'll be inability to move various parts of the body.
And that's observable through magnetic resonance
imaging.
Well,
I was going to get to that. That's observable, I mean, back to pre-Greek time, pre-antiquity, where people knew those kinds of things. But what we're getting to now is there are ways now of looking at the brain in a live person and looking at the anatomy of the brain. So that's where computed tomography came in. And CT is about, ooh, I may be wrong on this, for 25 years old. And then we got to magnetic resonance imaging, where without passing harmful x-rays through the body, by just looking at the magnetic field that the brain created and the rest of the body, we could look at things. But now we're getting to really exciting stuff where we can watch the function of the brain, not just the anatomy, but the function, so that you can be, there's things like SPECT scanning and PET scanning. And PET is really neat, positron emission tomography. And SPECT, which is single photon emission computed tomography. And what those are is that you inject into the person's bloodstream minute amounts of radioactively labeled oxygen or radioactively labeled glucose. And the brain needs glucose and the brain needs oxygen to function. And I'm talking about extremely tiny trace amounts of these radioactive materials. And you watch it as it goes through the brain, and then you take images, and you say to the person, okay, you show them a picture of something horrible, and you look at what part of the brain lights up. And then you show them something that's beautiful, and you watch what part of the brain lights up. Or you say, think about the last three letters of the alphabet, and you watch one part of the brain light up, think about the numbers 25 through 94, and you see another part. So we know, actually, we can watch what part of the brain is starting to do more metabolism, in other words, to oxygenate more glucose or degrade glucose in various parts of the brain, and we can see the functions that are there.
And we can
compare it with normals and abnormals.
How is this observed?
It's observed because these radioactive.
No, what kind of contraption? What kind of a gadget allows?
It's a scanner. It's a device that detects radioactivity, and so it makes a picture, a very fine picture, and we see increased radioactivity in the area where there's more glucose being utilized or more oxygen being taken up.
Can you tell us why there are abnormalities in some people's brains that causes them to be what we call crazy?
Well, why questions are really, really difficult, Barry. I mean, they're not only difficult, I try never to ask why questions.
That's why I like to ask them of a guy like you.
Well, I prefer what questions. Who, what, when, where, and not why. It's better to say, to see what we observe and then to try to have it make sense. So if someone comes into my office and they tell me that they've lost their appetite, that they're not sleeping, they've lost 20 pounds, they have difficulty concentrating, difficulty making decisions, that they have no interest in making love, they have little interest in life. They may even have some thoughts that life isn't worth living, or they may be suicidal. They say their mood is depressed and nothing gives them pleasure. These are cardinal symptoms. These are all the symptoms of, and they're slowed down. So I've just named all nine of the symptoms of major depressive disorder. Wouldn't it be interesting to take them in a laboratory and put their brain in a scanner and find out that certain parts of their brain are not getting the kind of oxygen that they should get? And then you take people who are just randomly chosen and matched for age and sex and similar backgrounds, etc., and their brains are working fine. Then you know what happens? You give the person who's depressed medicine that is specifically designed to cure depression, or, except for the most severely depressed patients, you put them into psychotherapy, and as they get better, you watch those areas of the brain start to function normally, and correlate that with the person saying, you know, I did go out in my garden yesterday, and I hadn't done that in the last 3 months, and ever since I started taking those pills, or ever since I started my twice-weekly psychotherapy, I've noticed that I have more interest in things, and I'm not standing in front of my t-shirt collection wondering whether I should put on the white one or the blue one. I can just walk into my closet and pull out the right one. And so the treatment, namely the medication or the psychotherapy, is working to make observable changes in the brain function that match line by line, so to speak, with the changes in the person's observed sense about how they feel about themselves in the world.
Well, the medicine enhances the neurotransmitters.
Roughly speaking, it does.
And the psychotherapy also enhances them by making people aware of the concerns or insights into themselves that they didn't have before?
Yeah, my metaphor is, it's like there's a record, and if anyone remembers what records were, those of us who were old enough, but it's like the needle's in the wrong track. I know there's really only one groove on a record side, but anyway, the needle's in the wrong place on the record, and the medicines pick it up and put it in a better place. And the psychotherapy can do that too. So instead of the person musing over and over depressive thoughts and self-defeating thoughts and negative thoughts, the person, as they feel better, just starts to think about... They take off the blinders of depression and they start seeing the world more as they saw it before.
Some people might characterize themselves as being a pessimist, always thinking that something will end up poorly. And some people are optimists. Is this tend to be a psychiatric condition that can be changed with psychotherapy and that can be changed with medicine?
Well, what's a psychiatric condition? Psychiatrists interest themselves in the problems that the people who come to them and call themselves patients present. And there are clearly borderline things, and there's some things that people would say, oh, don't tinker with that. But so someone comes in and says, you know, well, I run this software corporation and I lost $2 billion the other day when Microsoft stock went down and now I'm only worth $37 billion. Someone might say, hey, that's not a problem. But for Bill Gates, that might be a problem. And so if he came to my office, we would talk about it. We would find out what it is about that is bothering him. There's this, when you talk about people saying I'm a pessimist or I'm an optimist, everything that we do, I believe, is informed by a combination of three different layers of our existence. And these layers form a seamless structure. It's not like they're really separate, but it's just different ways of looking at it. The same way I could look at your pen as being a cylinder, or I could look at your pen as being a writing implement, or I could look at it as being a purple object, it didn't change the pen. So with the seamless structure, I like to look at the biology of what's going on, the personality of what's going on, and the environment. So when someone says I'm a pessimist, I would wonder if they've inherited a propensity, a predisposition to being a pessimist.
In the biology.
In the biological realm, right. So that's a genetic thing that was handed down from the parents or the grandparents.
That there's not a lot you can do about other than realize that's the way you are.
Well, there's more than that you can do about it, because our biology, our nature, interacts with, I'm going to skip over nurture for a second, with what we call our personality. And our personality is another facet of who we are, just the same way that you could say my blue eyes are part of my biology. You might say that my upbeat personality is part of my biology. That's just part of what I was born with. And every parent out there who's been in the delivery room and seen their child knows that on delivery day, each child has its own personality. But personality gets molded by our biology. So if you have epilepsy or if you have some painful chronic condition, that can wear away at our personality. And those are internal biological problems. Or one can see an environment and say, well, I grew up in the ghetto and all I saw was, you know, people being murdered and there was poverty and I didn't have enough food to eat and my parents hated me. So that could wear on a personality too. So I like to look at the mix of, on the inner layer of this ball of who we are, the biology, the middle layer is our personality and it's our temperament. And it's as unique to each person as our fingerprints are. It's our style, it's what we like and what we don't like and what we do well and what we don't do well. And then there's what we see as our environment. And they're all plastic, in that, plastic meaning changeable, in that you could say it's warm in this room, and I could say it's cold in this room. The thermometer doesn't change, but it's the way we perceive it that does. Or your personality could say, well, it's hot, and I'm going to sit here and suffer, and I could say it's hot, but I'm going to go and open the window. So there's always a mix of all three, and there's treatments available for all three. So when you said, oh, someone's born a pessimist, they're always a pessimist. There are specific biological treatments, there are specific psychological treatments, and there are specific environmental treatments. And that's what I, as a psychiatrist, a medical doctor specializing in these problems, likes to address. I like to be able to say, at a biological level, are you getting the nutrition that you need? Are you exercising regularly? How are your sleep habits? What substances are you taking in your body, be they things that we call drugs or things that we call medications or exposure to the leaky furnace that's putting carbon monoxide in your system? Are you getting out in the sunlight enough? And in the wintertime, if there's not enough sun, are you being exposed to other sources of bright light? And do you need electroconvulsive therapy? I mean, there's a bunch of different biological treatments that are available. There's psychological treatments, which include talk therapies, and there are many different types of talk therapy. And then there are environmental treatments that need to be done too. If you are having real great difficulty in your relationship with your spouse or relationship with your boss, can we look together at what's your fault there and what's the other person's fault and what changes can we make to make a better match?
I'd like to ask you about the personality aspect and the first experience. When someone has a profound first experience, it really affects how they will compare second experiences that are different from the first.
Maybe you should elaborate on that, but one that I'm thinking of is that with many people with substance abuse, the first time they shoot up heroin, they say they never can get that experience back.
Because it comes into a clean body.
It comes into a clean body. And it's like putting high-test gasoline in a car that's only been chugging along on something that's about 70 octane. And suddenly there's this 150 octane stuff. And the brain doesn't have the capability of making 150 octane stuff. And so, but they remember what that one high was like. And then heroin addicts or other addicts chase that high. They try to get it again. And then eventually the brain chemicals actually become depleted. And then they're not really trying to get the high anymore, they're just trying to stave off the lows, and so they're never even going to come back to normal.
And the kind of experience that I was thinking of is a child being bitten by a dog and forever dislikes dogs. Mm-hmm. Or someone who has a certain kind of food in their family as a child, they always like that kind of food.
Well, the brain is great. The brain is a very conservative organ, and it wants what it wants, and it wants to get it when it wants to get it, otherwise it gets very upset. And if it's been given great pleasure at some point, it seeks to get that pleasure again. So if when you were a kid and you remember your mom making a lima bean soup that you loved, then you're going to be forever chasing lima beans instead of heroin. It's probably a good bet.
Well, Richard Gardner, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I want to ask you the question I ask everyone at this time.
Which is?
Can you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
A book that I've read that I've really enjoyed is by a man named Rushworth Kidder. And it's called How Good People Make Tough Choices. And it's a book that describes not should I rob the bank or should I not rob the bank, which is not a good person making a tough choice. but choices that many of the big problems that face us in society and little problems that people face. I highly recommend it.
Richard Gardner, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Okay.
Richard Gardner is a practicing psychiatrist in Ukiah, California. The book that he recommends is How Good People Make Tough Choices by Rushworth Kidder. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.